Now we're leaving the hotel.
At the gate, we pass through a final gauntlet of Moroccan Mukhabarat, or intelligence agents. As we head to the plane, one of them says, "I hope you had a good time in Moroccan Sahara." Moroccan Sahara, the term the Moroccan government uses, but no country in the world officially recognizes. Morocco occupies Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. For Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, with John Hamilton, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan.
This has been a Democracy Now! Special, 4 days in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. A nearly three-decade ceasefire in Western Sahara recently ended after the Moroccan military broke into a southern no-go buffer zone on November 13th to attack Sahrawi civilians and exchange fire with the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence. As Morocco and the Polisario engage on the battlefront, dozens have been arrested in the occupied territory. Many of the Sahrawis in this film are currently under police siege or in hiding. 4 days in Western Sahara was directed by John Hamilton and produced with our news director, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan. Special thanks to Maria Carrion, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Brendan Allen, Hugh Grant, and all those who helped us along the way. All music by the late Sahrawi singer
Mariam. You're listening to
Hassan.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Friday. Mind the gap. We're going to bridge it, because girls are powerful. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. How's it going? This is The Gap on KBOO Portland. I'm Tammy. On the line with me is Althea. How's it going, Althea?
Hello. It's going all right.
Are you anything new under the sun for you?
New under the sun. That feels so broad. It feels like I could really say something that means something and something that means nothing. I don't know. I made some coffee, you know, ready to chat, ready to talk it up, yak it up, if you will. I've been having some coffee troubles lately, not using my preferred method, but my little sister has this milk frother, pretty fun little gadget. I think they're only like $10 at name any box store, you can foam stuff. I don't know, it's fun.
Can you use it for scrambled eggs too, like scrambling things or
you probably
up other
could.
Things?
Yeah, I know that there's like devices that are like a bigger scale version of one that you can like use to stir a pot for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, some gizmos. You know, I am torn between the school of thought that, you know, Alton Brown from the Food Network, it's like, you don't need these specialized gadgets. And it's like, sometimes you don't. You should learn how to just cut an avocado. And that's a good way to do it. That is a good way. But then other times it's like, one, gadgets are fun to do things that you couldn't do before. And two, some people, like, the gadgets make it easier for them, whether that's actually consuming that type of food or, like, accessibility-wise. All that to say is I enjoy this little milk frother.
I agree with you, because you got some gadgets that are, like, from the as seen on TV type thing, gadgets,
yeah.
That are kind of like, that's a little silly. It's cute and it works, but that's kind of silly. And then, you know, actual ones that you would need. So I'm glad that you're, you know, learning about new things, trying it out. And in the station, we have Sonia, per usual. Thank you again so much for, you know, being there for us. We are back in our homes because we can't be in station, but Sonia's braving it. And, you know, keeping us connected with all the listeners. So thank you so much, Sonia.
Anything new with you? Well, I'm pretty excited about today's guest. I was about to say KBOO's own, but you know, she flew on her own. She's doing her own thing now. We have Aaron Yankee will be joining us to discuss the It Did Happen Here project, including a podcast, and we'll be hearing more about that later on in the program.
Yes, not much. That's right. Sonia, you spilled the beans, but that's okay.
Oh, dang.
I feel like after a while at KBOO, you know, whether you want to or not, KBOO probably has a little bit of ownership on your soul, just a little bit.
Well, maybe that's not quite the way to put it. But, you know, yeah, it's like once a booer, always a booer. You know, you're like,
aww.
It gets in you.
Aww.
I know it's in
like
me.
That.
Is it in you?
yes, that's right. Aaron Yankee will be on in just a couple of moments. Oh, excuse me. To speak about the project, It Did Happen Here. It's a podcast which she's been working on. The executive producer for that podcast. So a lot of exciting stuff. We have a little bit of audio from there too. And the new episode came out this morning, so we'll get to that in just a moment. Is there anything else that we wanted, a little housekeeping we want to get out of the way first, Althea? I'm wondering.
I'm trying to think if there's stuff we should say before we get to that podcast. I am really excited to talk to Aaron. I was thinking, okay, here's my spin. KBOO alumni. Alumna?
Alumna. I like that.
Alumna. Yeah.
I like that. I like that. Okay, cool. And I don't know if we're ready to tell people yet, but we are on the social media. Althea, is that something?
Oh, yeah, put it out there. Why not?
On the social media, at The Gap Radio on the gram. That's where we're at. I guess I should use the full word for that. You can search us, The Gap Radio, on Instagram. We are on there. There's one post, I think, but like 10 followers. So if you want to be the 11th one, that's on you. You know, we're really waiting for you to raise the bar for us. But
Once you start following, we'll post all the time. And it's a good way to get in contact with us as well if you want to message us on there.
Questions, comments, concerns, you know, that'll be a appropriate place for those type of things. And if you are in the community and doing great things and would like to speak with us too, you can get in touch with us on there. And don't forget, after each episode, we do post a web page onto kboo.fm. Althea, with her skills and generosity, is the one spearheading that part while I'm just jabbering on. So thank you, Althea, for all that work.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good, if we talk about something on the show that is internet related, I'll link it on there as well.
Yeah,
what's a good word for the kind of things that we talk about on the show?
musings. So like news, but also musings. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
You're welcome. $5. But I guess everything has a price. unless you're a KBOO alum. And speaking of which, I guess it's about that time.
Segway.
Segway. We need a button.
We should just call him out.
Button.
We should just yell when we're going to make a segue. Segway.
Segway to our interview today. So I think Aaron Yankee is on the line.
True.
Oh, hey, Aaron. How are you?
I am good. Just a couple things. I still actually have a radio show on KBOO, so I'm just a KBOO volunteer.
Okay.
So I am no longer just to clarify that, and I think the news, muse, and views, you can just there you go, there's you got some cadence.
Oh, you're taking that away for free.
So Tammy, you have to give Aaron a cut of your $5 from Althea now.
I know, $1.50 for you, Aaron. Can you
thanks for watching my back, Sonia.
Can you tell the listeners what program you're still doing on the air every other Wednesday?
Every other Wednesday at 10 o'clock, I do a show called Life During Wartime with The Wolfman and Matt C., and we just play punk rock music and talk more about the world and things I'm mad at and the reasons that I play them, you know, like, oh, look, police brutality, let's play a bunch of anti-police songs, or, oh, look, like, you know, this is still happening, you know. So, yeah, so I have a little bit more, it's a little bit more of like a personal platform for me, but yeah, every other Wednesday, years and years of archives on the KBOO website. So we actually used to have tons of live bands play on there, so if you miss live music, you could listen to old shows and pretend like there's live music happening on the radio, which I've found helpful personally. So there's another resource.
Just yet another way that community radio comes through for you, the listener, every day.
Every day. Every day or every other Wednesday as well.
Including every other Wednesday. And then the alternating Wednesdays, and then Thursday through Tuesday as well.
Are we just gonna do the schedule now? No, I'm kidding. I appreciate you being on here. I know that you have all the stuff that you're working on, and the latest episode of the podcast, It Did Happen Here, came out this morning. Now, I do have a little bit of a clip from episode 2 that just kind of gives it a brief overview of what the podcast is. Sonia, if you could play that, and then we'll get back to Aaron.
He was an Ethiopian immigrant. He'd come here, and I guess he was a college student. You know, I don't know him personally at all, but I mean, that's just an innocent person, you know, who came here for school and a better life, and these guys killed him.
The crime took place here on Southeast 31st early Sunday morning. Three black men, all from Ethiopia, were sitting in this car talking. When one left to head for his apartment, another car pulled up. Three young white men jumped out and began beating him. There were also two women with the three skinheads, women who stayed in their car, but who shouted encouragement.
They never say anything. Just the girls, they're screaming inside, and they say, kill, you know, kill him, or beat him, you know.
Dead is 27-year-old Mulugeta Sarau.
We're all hanging out at this apartment on 21st Street. There was like 20 of us. Someone brought the news that they'd killed somebody, those people that we'd been fighting. And it was like this silence. We were all like, oh my God, this is real. Ish, this is real. We knew that it was, but having someone killed like that, I mean, and it was like a sadness, and kind of like we realized that what we had actually been fighting was something that we totally needed to fight.
The murder of Mulugeta Sarau hit the city hard. Even today, many Portlanders remember the moment when they first heard the news. People who lived in the Kearns neighborhood, site of the murder, were shocked to learn of their racist neighbors. This was not shocking to black and queer Portlanders, indigenous people, immigrants, and punks, all targets of the young neo-Nazi gangs. City leaders could no longer gaslight frightened teens or marginalized populations. It was the beginning of a civic defense that would forever change Portland.
Thank you. And that was a bit of an intro from episode 2 from the podcast, It Did Happen Here. On the line with us today here on The Gap on KBOO is Aaron Yankee, the executive producer of this here podcast. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for, you know, highlighting this story. Can you talk a little bit about what made you start this project and what kind of support you had on it?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I'm super stoked to be here. So when Mulugeta was murdered, I was not living in Portland, but I was living on the West Coast, and it definitely, like, I was doing my last year of high school, actually, in Sacramento, California, and Sacramento had its own skinhead problems, and I often went to punk shows in the Bay Area, and they had a skinhead problem, so we just, you know, everyone was kind of dealing with skinheads, And then when we found out about the murder of Mulugeta, it was just like, kind of like trying to describe, she was the woman who spoke, just like really heavy, and like, these guys are capable of murder. They're not just bullies who like to, you know, mess around with people at the punk shows and get in fights. Like, they're definitely being politicized by, you know, white nationalists, and we all need to start like stepping up and being more organized, because that's what's happening in our scene. So it definitely affected me personally on an emotional level, and then later on, as I was more involved in punk scenes in an organizing level with more, I was never officially a part of Anti-Racist Action, which is a group that started Mike Crenshaw, who is the last voice you heard. He's one of the narrators and probably very familiar to KBOO listeners. So he grew up in the Midwest and was one of the founders of the Minneapolis Baldies, which was a group of skinheads who fought the white nationalist skinheads, and that group ended up into a regional group and then a national group called Anti-Racist Action. So I knew about this group way years and years before I ever met Mike, which is really cool to then end up like working with him, you know, years later, and then be like, oh my God, blah, 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 blah. So, so that's kind of one stream of things that were happening just personally. And then, well, I'm not quite sure on the years of all of this stuff, but for the support, it's like, okay, how do you tell the story? There's a lot of pieces to it. There are people who, it's very complicated and also not very known. So there's a lot of digging and interviews that need to be done. And there was a woman who was a fan of KBOO. Her name was Martha Davis. And I would say she probably died about 10 years ago or so. And she left a bequest to KBOO that half of it was to fight the Christian right and half of it was to fight or to support Native programmers. It took KBOO maybe like 8 years to actually get the money, because there was some drama, because she had a lawyer that was that did some embezzling, and then they got caught and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there's some drama around that. But then we got the money. There was a bunch of action that happened to support the Native programmers, and there's like a little podcast production studio at the PSU Native and Family Center. And then this other half of the money to fight the Christian right was something that kind of just was like in my brain of like, well, the Christian right has become the alt-right. They just rebranded, you know, so Patriot Prayer, blah, 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 pretty easy to see the connections. And that also was their development. It's like, okay, everyone is, you know, quote, everyone is really freaked out about like Patriot Prayer and then the Antifa support for them and all that. So I was like, this is actually just another cyclical or another cycle of what we were fighting and protesting against when I was a teenager. What a perfect use of the funds to get out to be like, we've done this already. We've done the same things, and also it was an incredibly different time in the pre-internet world. So let's get these stories out so that the folks who are fighting this fight now can like have an idea that they're not alone and that they're part of a historical continuum, and that there are not only like things to learn both to do and not do from what we had done before, but also like there are, you know, there are people who are in their 50s, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, who actually, like, are supportive of what they're doing, because I think that they never hear any support from what they're doing. So there's people who support them who just are not people who can go fight in the streets anymore. And just, like, to kind of help place that in some historical context. So
yeah,
that happened. And then because it was KABU. So we got the grant. I made a proposal, and we got the grant from KABU. That took a while as well. Things are just changing so quickly. So we started. I did the first interview last October, I think. So there was a lot of prep work and like finding the people and all that. And then, you know, I was like, great, we're gonna interview maybe like five to ten people. It'll be like a 2 or 3 episode thing. And then just everyone was like really into being talked to and like, let me contact my friends. Let me get a hold of them for you. Oh, you need to talk to this person and this person. And so it kind of ballooned into what it is now, which is I think we interviewed about 25 or so people, and it'll be end up being 11 episodes, and there's like a small team of us who are working on it. And the other part too is that we were Selena Flores, who's one of the producers as well, she was kind of like the like finding people to interview and setting up all the time and all of that stuff. And then she ended up doing a bunch of interviews. And we got to pay a good handful of KABU volunteers. I think 7 people did an interview and got paid for it through that fund. So people got some experience. And then I was like, great, I'll just edit it. But then all these people kept coming through with more interviews. So Selena and I ended up both doing a ton of interviews. And then Mike Crenshaw also did a bunch of interviews because he went back to the folks that he started ARA with and interviewed them. So this is the third episode that kind of introduces the Portland context. Episode 4 is all about the Minneapolis Baldies and kind of how that grew to be national and then came back to Portland. Then we'll have episode 5 that is about the Portland ARA. And then there's 6 episodes after that that I can talk about, but I've been talking a really long time, so there's probably questions.
Yeah, I have a question for you. So I listened to the first 2 episodes, and I want to congratulate you and Mike and Selena and the whole team because it sounds so good, and it's a very, very interesting story. And so I want to broad stroke it for the listeners and correct me if I'm wrong, but that the podcast traces the history of the 80s punk scene in Portland from the murder of Mulugeta Sarraw to anti-racist action, this group chasing neo-Nazis out of Portland. I'm curious if you could give us a little bit of background about what the relationship is between punk skinheads and Nazi skinheads.
Sure. That is... Okay, I gotta write that down. So... the reason it's about the punk scene in particular is that we were all part of, or, you know, the very many of us were part of it, but the neo-Nazis were just a physical presence in Portland, period. So they wanted to be part of the punk scene, so they would show up to punk shows. But they were, like, people were much more in public space at the time, so... You know, at the Galleria in downtown, there was a Pioneer Square. There's a place called The Wall on it where everyone would hang out at the time. It gets mentioned in the podcast, like a little more descriptive of that. So people would hang out. So you'd be like, get off the bus and walk downtown. And then the neo-Nazi skinheads would then like, look, you're by yourself. You look like a freak. We're going to beat you up. Or you're by yourself. You're an immigrant. Or you're an immigrant man with your family. We're going to beat you up. And the city just wasn't really doing anything about it. They were, you know, now we can see it as gaslighting or not listening or paying attention to the needs of the citizens. But being that the Nazi skinheads also wanted to be at the punk shows, that's why that was a very that's like an arena for the violence and the action. So skinheads have been a part of the punk scene since the early 80s. Is very much a look from that came from England, that before that had come from Jamaica. which is very interesting for, you know, the
white irony, right?
Neo-Nazis and white supremacists, exactly. It's like, let's steal black culture, but hate black people, you know, very white supremacist. So that is why the punk scenes were, or the punk shows were an arena for a lot of that. And also, like, the music is really aggressive. It's really easy to be in, it's really easy, I think, to be an outsider for it and see, like, the pit or see, like, this dancing and not see it as, like, a cathartic way where people are all together, because that is how it is experienced as someone who belongs to the culture, until there is, like, the element of violence that comes in, and then, you know, you get, then it's a really easy place for fights to start, you know. So it hasn't been like that for me since I was probably, you know, 19. I don't know if I've been around one, but definitely in the early days, you know, I think my first encounter with a skinhead was right around there. And they were, I was trying to cut through the pit to get to the front to see the band play, and then it all started up and I was like not prepared for it, so I tried to leave, and then a skinhead like grabbed me by my jaw, and he just held me. He's much, I'm like 5'3" or something, and he's like 6 whatever, so he's holding me by my jaw and like kind of squeezing it, and like, you know, it's hurting my jaw, but I'm also swinging at him, but I can't reach him because his arms are much longer than mine. So I remember in the moment, like, this is such a, like, Tom and Jerry cartoon moment of, like, trying to hit someone and not being able to reach them. And also, like, being furious that this, like, you know, neo-Nazi was trying to control my, you know, evening and my experience at the show. So, which made me just more determined to, like, go to more shows and be more a part of it and, like, learn how to fight them, because clearly me swinging at them when I can't reach them is not my most effective tool. So.
Now, you mentioned violence, and obviously for the last few months in Portland and all over the country, we've been seeing, you know, so many things happen, you know, from the outbreak of the coronavirus and how it's been getting people a little bit more irate, to the, I guess, the uprisings and the protests, and how you'll be seeing protesters and counter-protesters, and obviously there has been bloodshed and a death on the streets during these type of protests. And a lot of people are, you know, we've had people call in the show, and, you know, people off the air, and even in casual conversation, where people say, well, how can you justify the violence? Why don't they just do it peacefully? And, you know, obviously, you know, I guess folks' memories are short, because this has been a problem, as you said, and we are in a cycle where it's happening again. So I guess, how would you answer those type of questions? People say, well, why would you resort to violence? Violence plus violence, you know, violence begets violence. How can you reach a peaceful conclusion this way? What would you say to that?
I think that it's not anyone's first choice to be violent, but when you get groups of people who are trying to deny your existence, then they're going to be like, oh, I have the right to tell you how to live, which also means, like, you shouldn't live, to judge whether you should live or die, and then go after you so that you can't live a life that you want to. Like, how are you going to stop that? You can't, you know, there's no amount of rational thought, like, oh, well, let's compromise on if you think I have the right to live or not. Let's see, maybe I could just have a half-life. Like, you know, like, it just doesn't work like that. You know, that's pretty ridiculous. So the fact that people, you know, that white people in particular, white men, think that they can judge whether people of color or immigrants or women or queers can live or die, and then act on that because they feel like it, is something that needs to be stopped. And if there is any other way to stop it besides violence, then I think people also engage in that. So, like, if you are, you know, a lot of it's all, I feel like that this mindset is all based on fear, and they're afraid of giving up power, and they're also afraid of the unknown and people they don't know. And people who have robust and rich social lives are not afraid of other people. And people who are like stuck in a basement of their mom as a, you know, incel or whatever, are not having rich social lives where they can appreciate other people. So, and I also think that like the violence of people defending themselves is not nearly the same as the violence of people who come into Portland with massive shotguns and, you know, try to have social control over, much more multicultural city than it was back in the 80s and 90s, that's for sure. So that's what I think. I think that people who, and then also the other thing, blah, blah, blah. So people who then are on the sidelines who are like, oh, the violence, and they're kind of hand-wringing about the violence if they're not directly into it, because the police routinely protect the Proud Boys and routinely uphold state power and social power and are not actually there to protect the people, that, you know, those of us who feel strongly are the ones who are stepping forward to like defend this multicultural and rich, varied, you know, lots of kinds of people around, lots of, you know, I mean, not right now so much for the public space, but as actually, you know, being a real city with a lot of different kinds of people around. And so I think the Antifa people and the people who are like, we are doing self-defense for our community members, and then the people who hand-wring about that violence, is that they're just, like, if you want to live in a city, but you don't want to defend your city against people who are white nationalists and white power and who want to make it a monolithic culture that has one kind of person and, you know, very hierarchical power or whatever it is, then it's kind of the Setify thing. Setify, someone else does it for you. So there's like, I take responsibility for my own culture. If I see people in trouble, I will take care of them. We have mutual aid, whether that is violence or not, whether it's fighting or not. Like, we do what needs to be done. We take care of each other because we are a community and we are in it together. And I think the Setify, the someone else does it for you, is like, well, the police can take care of it, except for the police have a history of being more aligned with the white nationalists and white supremacists, or, you know, someone else will do it for me so I can just hand-wring about the violence and not see my own culpability in upholding white supremacy.
And in the latest episode, there is a group called, or an organization called the Committee for Human Rights, is that the right name?
Coalition for Human Dignity.
I was close. And that is an interesting group, because while there was the lack for a better word, the street fighters, there is also kind of the next layer of it, which is more organized. And I actually have a little bit of a clip, Sonia, if you could play. It's called Interview Audio 2. It speaks to that a little bit. And then, Aaron, we'll get back to you if you could just kind of tell us what we listen to. And by the way, this is The Gap on KBOO Portland. On the line with us is Aaron Yankee, the executive producer for the new podcast, It Did Happen Here. And we're going to listen to just a couple of moments of audio from the latest episode that came out this morning.
It's hard to describe the effect the tragic incident had on Portlanders. It wasn't shock at the brutal murder. This was, after all, a city that had been under a quiet siege. It was the realization that the problem was deeper than the brutes themselves, that the city was not addressing regular attacks on its citizens, that the police ignored ongoing violence of murderous youths, that the only place left to turn was to each other.
After the death of Mulugeta Sarah, a group of Ethiopian students mainly centered around Portland State University called for a rally. And so Ethiopians did the initial organizing, and hundreds of people showed up. And this white guy showed up, asked to speak. So it turned out that was Neil Goldsmith, governor of Oregon. He realized that there's a movement here and it must be co-opted because there's anger here. And there's also something going on here that's, I'm sure he recognized it as a Jewish man. These are neo-Nazis and we have to deal with it. So I don't want to completely dismiss his concerns, but just say that from the start, there was always an active effort to take this new movement and put it back in traditional Democratic Party stuff.
But the fascist movement could not be contained by liberal political maneuvering. A political solution would not protect the growing number of people getting assaulted on the streets. Scott Nakagawa and M. Trelor elaborate.
So following the Sarah murder, a group called the Coalition for Human Dignity was formed. It was a coalition between the city of Portland and a variety of different community organizations here. At this time, things like the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the American Friends Service Committee, the Lesbian Community Project, etc. Groups that were concerned about hate crimes here.
Thank you, Sonia. So that was a bit from the most recent episode that came out this morning of It Did Happen Here. And Aaron, can you talk a little bit for the last few minutes that we have you on here? Thank you for allowing this interview to go a bit longer. Can you talk a little bit about this group and also kind of if we do have something that's anything like that now, helping out folks that are on the front lines?
So the last voice you heard was Scott Nakagawa. He also former KBOO volunteer. He was a co-host on a show called Boneheads and Bigots back in the day that talked about the boneheads is a slang term for the neo-Nazi skinheads. So kind of shorthand. And M. Trelor was the first interview voice you heard. Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw as the narrators both showed up in there. So the Coalition for Human Dignity, like Scott said, started out as this like multicultural, like all these different activist groups meeting together of like, what's this problem with the neo-Nazi skinheads? Let's organize. And the city was involved. They met in the city council chambers, and there was a rift pretty quickly where a lot of the more active oriented people wanted to travel to Idaho for a neo-Nazi gathering and have some confrontation, and the city was worried about insurance, and so they pulled out of the coalition. So the Coalition for Human Dignity that we mostly talk about is the second group that still had a variety of groups involved with it, but they were definitely decided to take the approach of like, if we're going to get rid of the white supremacist neo-Nazi boneheads, then our best defense is a good offense, and we are going to go after them where they live and they work and in the punk scene. So they did a lot of support around that. They also, when there was a picnic in Laurelhurst Park on Hitler's birthday, quote unquote, and then the Nazis were going to gather. So then the coalition and the Sharps and Anti-Racist Action were going to have a picnic in the same park. The anti-fascist, anti-racist much outnumbered the Nazis. So the Nazis kind of left. After they left, the cops came and harassed and arrested the anti-racist organizers. That might sound familiar to some of you. So what the coalition did then was like, you did it wrong. We're writing letters to the editor. We're making more publicity and standing up for these kids. They also did a lot of research into who the groups were and who the people were and what the problems were, and a lot of investigation and connecting groups together and really realizing the depth of the radicalization and indoctrination that people were getting from more national white supremacist groups. The people who are doing that now, I think, I don't know very much about them. I know that what has now become doxing, like the Antifa folks are doing that within. They're very private, and so I don't actually know them or who what's happening, but I've seen that happen. I think Pop Mob does a little bit of the standing up against the white nationalists and white supremacists when they show up, but I'm not sure how much of the investigative work is happening kind of on the ground. We now have gigantic organizations like the Western State Center, with Eric Ward, executive director, who was part of the Coalition for Human Dignity. And then there's national organizations like the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights in Kansas City. And they have a lot of the files and work that the CHD did. Theoretically, that was something we were going to check in on, and then COVID hit, so no one has been in their office for a long time to be able to check that out. So there are groups that are doing the watchdog work. I'm sure there are groups that are doing the like the infiltration work. You know, there are groups that there are right wing groups, I'm sure, doing the infiltration work, or the police doing infiltration work on the leftists. So but I just don't know who they are, and I don't think at the time people knew that CHD was doing that kind of work as well. Like, now that it's been 25 years, in the interviews people would talk more about it, that it was happening, but we didn't talk to anyone who admitted to doing it. And, you know, it needs to stay private for safety reasons still, I'm sure.
Right.
And yeah, I think that is there's definitely, like, you know, this, there's definitely other groups that people that we interviewed work with that I didn't write down, or I can't find where I wrote down their names, but we have, one of the things about the podcast is that there's very extensive show notes. Iggy A and Mo Baustern have been working really hard on the narration, and then the show notes have a lot of stuff that, like, where Scott is like, the Lesbian Community Center, the ACT UP, the blah, blah, blah. So in the show notes, there's a lot, there's like a paragraph of those histories and more links to them. So things that people might not catch, we hopefully caught a lot of them in the show notes so that you can dig deeper even into this time period in this history.
Awesome. Very thorough work. So before we wrap up, I just have two more questions, and they are, well, I guess two and a half. I asked you this yesterday, and I hope that you have an answer about when you were doing this work, you know, working on the podcast and hearing all of these stories, some you may have known, some not. What was the most surprising thing that you learned while working on this project?
The most surprising thing that I learned was how much, like, the Coalition for Human Dignity in particular had lots of groups all over the Pacific Northwest, like small chapters in lots of little rural places. Almost every city had a, you know, cities to the size of Spokane. There was just a lot of groups everywhere. And then I can't remember whose interview this was, but when the Southern Poverty Law Center sued the Aryan Nations and won their compound in Idaho, it kind of signaled to the world and to the community, like, oh, people had kind of decided, like, we won. And so funder stopped funding. The Coalition for Human Dignity had a harder time getting funding. They'd also, like, focused on other issues and kind of just dissolved at a certain point, which left all of these, you know, rural groups without support or some financial backing. So they all closed up. And then here we are again, where people are, like, needing to fight again, especially in rural areas. And there's the Rural Organizing Project, which is fantastic, but, you know, they have a lot of chapters everywhere. But the way that the left organizes with nonprofit money and then just has to, like, start over because issues change or cycles change is, like, we're very excellent at shooting ourselves in the foot for long-term organizing. And the way that the right wing, like, I personally, as a young person, was like, we won. There are not Nazis on the street anymore. This is, you know, like, where it just felt more free. And then knowing now later that's like, oh, they did a quick pivot to the internet to do, like, you know, they're, like, amazing internet organizers for, like, despicable things. But, you know, there's like, a long view that the white nationalists are really excellent at that we are so bad at, we as those who, the anti-racist, anti-fascist people. So I kind of knew it, but this really, like, gave anecdotal stories to it that was pretty depressing. And the other thing too was that people talk about, like, you know, trauma bonding or gaslighting, or there's things in the interviews that we say now that no one had words for back then. So it was really interesting to me to be like, oh yeah, this, we had trauma bonds from this, or the city was gaslighting us, and how just, like, vocabulary has actually caught up to fit some of the needs of, like, what we were going through back then, which I think was pretty cool and interesting.
Awesome. I do have a quick question for you, Aaron. Since we are going a little bit longer, would you mind if we opened up phone lines for callers to call and ask questions?
Let's go for it. Sure, why not?
Sure. Callers, if you'd like to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. And I guess what type of advice would you have for young folks, older folks, just anyone who is seeing, you know, the evolution of, or the, you know, people becoming more emboldened in their white supremacist views and action? What would you say to folks that are trying to combat it in, you know, not necessarily physically, but maybe physically, but what kind of advice do you have?
I think the best thing that you can do is organize where you're at with people that are on the same page as you. Like, I still can't throw a punch, so I'm not going to be a street fighter, but I can, like, talk to, you know, it's all kind of just the basic organizing, like, all right, let's let know my neighbors, and if something goes down, we know how to get a hold of each other to protect each other. If there are Patriot Prayer, Proud Boy rallies, and you feel like confronting them on the front lines, always go with a friend. Like, have as much, like, safety equipment as you can. There's people who've been doing this for a long time, so getting, like, actual advice. You can also go to these events and stay, like, a block away and probably, you know, possibly get tear gas, but not, you know, the physical confrontation of fighting will probably not happen. So there's the people who have rallies, like, four blocks away. It's like, we don't want to feed into their attention. You know, we'll have, like, the pop mom dance party or those things. So there's a lot of ways to take a stand. I think if you can, supporting the, you know, financially donating to Western States Center or to the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights is great. And also just, like, speaking up more in a casual way. Like, you just hear a lot of time casually just people talking about Antifa in negative ways. And I think that you could, you know, people can, like, butt in and be like, actually, I think that this, the part where they defend the community, is really helpful. And so, you know, sometimes it's hard to figure out how to butt in the conversations, but, you know, you can organize letter writing campaigns. You can do things that feel, like, ineffectual and, you know, like, but every bit of people taking a stand against white nationalists and white supremacy helps. And it helps other people see that they are not alone. Even if you take action that you're like, this isn't going to do anything, like, every little step helps everyone to get together and to create a world where that is not tolerated. And I think that that is where we need to be. So, you know, you just kind of do what you can, and if you don't know what to do, there are people who've been doing it a long time. There's an app that the called Trepper, T-R-E-P-P-E-R, and it's the anti-bigotry app. So it helps you to be able to, like, record and like racist graffiti or hate crimes or other things, and there's tons and tons of articles and resources on that to get involved. And that's at a national level, and I think Western State Center is great at the local level, and there's also just, like, all these kids still going out every night protesting and showing up against the Proud Boys. So, you know, maybe going to one of their more public things, or maybe going to their trash cleanup. I think they have a trash cleanup on Sunday, and be like, you know, I could go up to them as a stranger and be like, I am a, you know, chubby middle-aged white lady. What can I do to support? I don't know how to throw a punch. What do you need from me? And then, you know, ask people what they need, and then hopefully they know enough of what they need to tell you. And there you go. You know, this is how we make community. It's slow, but it lasts.
Yeah, we talk oftentimes about community here, and, you know, being neighborly, and it all goes back to developing a stronger sense of connection with your community, but not what can my community do for me, rather what can I do for my community. So I truly do appreciate that. Althea, do you have any questions? I just kind of been going on.
Yeah, where can people find the podcast, Erin?
Oh, right now you can find it on Apple Podcasts and also on the KABU website and on our own website called It Did Happen Here podcast.com. We're working on other platforms, but, you know, we're also still working on the podcast, and we're working on the social media, and we're working regular jobs and all kinds of stuff. So, so right now we've got the three platforms, and I think on the KABU website, I think if you just search for It Did Happen Here, it comes up pretty quick.
You mentioned that as you were working on producing the podcast, that the scope of it enlarged past Portland, and that some of that gets covered in later episodes. Can you give us a little taste of what other episodes are going to entail?
Ooh, yes. So next week will be about the Minneapolis Baldies and then the founding of the ARA, which we talked about a little. Then after that we come back to Portland and the founding of Portland ARA here. And then get into a little bit of, like, the episode 6 is about house defense. So there's a couple pretty intense stories of, like, people walking down Cesar Chavez and Nazis, you know, like, you always kind of watch to see the taillights, and then they would, like, turn around and chase you. So there was a elderly black lady who led into kids who were running from the neo-Nazis, and then the neo-Nazis came back to her house later and, like, harassed her and attacked her. So the ARA and CHD and Sharps would go to people's houses and stay there to help defend them from the neo-Nazis. So there's a couple stories about that and how that worked. There's one of getting more into this work of the CHD, so more of the investigative stuff that maybe wasn't publicly known at the time, but internally, like, they ended up having, like, 30 file cabinets full of information on people in the Pacific Northwest who were white nationalists, white supremacists. Then it kind of gets into the ARA was like made up of, you know, skinheads, young people, punks, and all that. And then part of them were the Sharps, the skinheads against racial prejudice. And they kind of developed into a stronger presence of people who would fight the neo-Nazi skinheads, but also like kind of got less political, and like you could agree on that everyone hates Nazis, but then maybe they weren't super feminist, or they had other politics that it wasn't so easy to work with them on stuff. So we talk about that kind of becoming more of the of what was actually happening. And then there's a story, episode 9 is the story of John Bear, who is a local local sharp skin. I'm not sure which group he was claiming at the time, but on the New Year's of going into 1993, there was a fight with skinheads, and he actually ended up killing a skinhead and going to jail. So it's his story of fighting, like, you know, fighting the skinheads, like, literally to death. So from there, that really changed a lot of what happened and how the skinheads, the neo-Nazi skinheads, you know, were present. So the episode 10, we call Less Booted, More Suited, which is where the neo-Nazis grow their hair out and they maybe start putting on khakis and they maybe blend in more to society and still are not, still continuing their work, but just not in a street fighting kind of way. Like, that's how they sort of evolved out of the street fighting. And then, so that kind of, those two kind of like sort of end the era that we're looking at. And then the last episode is about people's sort of reflections on the time and the successes and failures, and a little, like, there's not really there was more advice in there, but I think as we started working on it with especially at the beginning when the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer were such kind of a focus, and then with the death of George Floyd and the uprising of Black Lives Matter as the movement for Black Lives on the street every night, like, that protesting has looked really different. So there's much less advice in that, like, old way, because it's a different world yet again. So but it kind of just catches up on, like, you know, we try to narrow, you know, we try to have kind of an ending. It's even, it's a little bit artificial of just like, okay, we're going to end it at this time because different groups then still kept organizing. And then 10 years later, you know, Portland Antifa was founded, and they're they were the first Antifa group in the United States, you know,
speaking,
and a lot
of an ending
these
point.
Organizers. So, so all that kind of stuff, like, gets kind of thrown into the last episode.
So speaking of throwing things in at the end, I think we have Freeman X on the line who has a question for Aaron. I've got to do a little juggling, so everyone just sit tight for a minute while I try to make this work. Stand by. All right, do we have everyone still with us? Aaron and Freeman X, are you both with us?
I am with us.
Freeman X is here. Good morning,
yay!
Aaron. I'll be quick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. One question I was going to ask is if the series was complete, and I think you just answered that. The series is complete. But I'm curious. I'm born and raised here in Portland. I know the case pretty well. Nobody interviewed me. Did you interview some African-American people that lived in Portland at the time?
Absolutely. We had Ron Herndon is very much in the first couple episodes for it. Perfect. As a, if you'd like to tell the community, I bet you have a better range of what Ron Herndon as an activist has done. I can if you don't want to.
Hero. He's a hero for sure. Ron Herndon. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm glad you got some of the local black folks here in town, because I lived here and nobody asked me. But I'm glad you got some folks, so that's very cool.
Yeah, Ron Herndon, and the woman that spoke, who was the first episode, the first clip that we played, China, was a black teenage skinhead at the time. So she is very prominent in there. Mike Crenshaw as a participant and narrator. So yeah, But thanks for asking.
Great work. And, That's how cable rocks. Thank you all. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we have the 11 episodes. We are also continuing to work on them as they come out. So number 4 is almost done, but will be done next Friday. So we're still continuing.
And they do come out every Friday morning, you said?
Every Friday, yes. Hopefully we will continue to, you know, we reserve the right to skip a week and catch up. But yeah, that's our goal, is every Friday.
Well, thank you so much, Erin. Just give that one last link for how people can listen to the podcast.
It Did Happen Here podcast.com is the best place. And then we also have the Instagram and the Twitter, so you can follow along on there. And thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us, Erin.
Yeah, this was wonderful. Yay. I'm excited to hear the rest of the series.
Cool. Yeah, me too.
Well, you take care, and thank you for all the work that you do organizing and broadcasting and all of that. We have just about a couple of seconds left. I want to say thank you to everyone, Althea, Sonia. This has been The Gap here on KBOO Portland. I'm Tammy. Althea, thank you again. Have a fantastic Friday, Althea and Sonia.
Bye, y'all. Yeah, thank you so much.
Take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Hey, KBOO listeners. It's another big give day for Willamette Week's Give Guide. Just for today, Give Guide has a Black Pack Black Friday offer. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get a chance to